Good morning. Families bearing the financial and social costs of caring for an elder at home could get some respite from a pair of Hawaii bills. They'd create a fund to ease the effect on working family caregivers. Campaign Director for Care for Our Kapuna, Pedro Haro, joins us. Many parents obsess over cleanliness with hand sanitizers in every bag and antibacterial everything around the house. Dr. Brett Finley says that's counterproductive to building immunity. We'll talk with him later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Songs of love and a song of protest in our studio. Willow Chang has created a Valentine concert on the seven kinds of love recognized by the ancient Greeks. And Keith Haugen looks at a lifetime of performing protest songs.
It's a Monday, February 6th. Those conversations and a few more coming up right after this news. Good morning and welcome back to Work Week. It's a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich and welcome to the conversation. Hello there, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Who knew that quality of life would be so hard to attain in the remaining years of life for so many?
I mean, there was this idea of the golden years,
yeah,
and retirement and all the wonderful things that would happen then and afterward. But as we've seen and as many families are experiencing, trying to care for an elder is anything but golden. Now, ask most people where they want to spend their elder years, and they'll likely say, at home. Now, while that can contribute to the health and longevity of older family members, the ones who care for them are often in a bind, work less to personally give care, or work more to afford the escalating costs. The legislative session companion bills in the State House and Senate would create the Kapuna Caregivers Program. It's a fund available to working family caregivers. Pedro Haro is the campaign director for Care for Our Kapuna. It's a local movement to create a legislative plan for long-term care. He joins us now in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
For families who are coping with this, and we know that we live in the state that has, if not the longest lived members, certainly one of them, it's tough to be able to have to make choices. Do I leave office early? Do I go to all these appointments with my elder family member? Do I bathe him or her? I mean, what all these things that people find themselves asking questions that they never really thought they were going to have to ask before. But then there's the real money factor, too. So how does this attempt to address both of those issues?
Oh, and definitely. You're 100% right. People are having to face these difficult decisions that many times we didn't even plan for. Even though we know that it's coming, even though we know that growing old with age is a factor of life, I always tell people, we always figure that that's one thing that's free, is growing older. And unfortunately, it's one of the most costly experiences that we have in our lives. We have talked to people all over who are saying, you know, I have to make that decision whether I take the promotion that means a little bit more responsibility, maybe a few more hours, or taking care of mom at home. And a lot of times, they're going to take mom... taking care of mom over that promotion, and it's really unfortunate because right as the cost of care continues to rise, if they're reducing their hours or reducing their income levels, it's getting hit twice. So that's what these bills are trying to get at.
And Pedro, is especially for women, because I noticed that you said taking care of mom. Well, we know that women generally outlive men. We also
right.
know that women are much more predisposed to be the ones to say, hey, I'll cut back, I'll take care of likely mom, but in many cases could be dad. The idea that somehow this is disadvantaging women, disadvantaging women more than men, hasn't really been addressed that much.
You know, I think it's a really wonderful issue to bring up. The idea, we've seen the Women's March that was here in Hawaii, across the nation as well, in really having that equality for women. And one of those unspoken rules that happens in families is that women usually become the caregivers for kupuna in their families. That's with their own parents and also with in-laws. So that does impede their ability to be able to grow in a workforce that then they have to leave early. And then unfortunately, we see this sandwich generation. There was somebody who used that term of women and men who were having to take care of elderly parents or grandparents and then children as well. And so you see this sandwiching effect of having to receive the stress from both sides. And that's the point of this caregiver's bill, is to provide in assistance to those caregivers, but also shine attention to all of those unpaid caregivers, hundreds of thousands across the islands that provide this needed care. Most of the time, they are the best caregivers for their family. Their family want them in to be there in their golden years. They just need that bit of assistance that these bills provide to be able to do that.
So let's talk about how that happens. We talk about a fund that would allow a working caregiver to draw about $70 a day. How is that fund actually created?
So right now at the legislature, there's a Senate Bill 534 and House Bill 607 that would create about a $6 million fund to begin with on its first program year that families would be able to draw from, about $70 a day, as you mentioned, to be able to provide services that they need most for their family. So that would include things like transportation or perhaps having somebody, a home health aide, come in for a few hours. This does not provide 24 hours a day care. It's not meant for that. Unfortunately, we tried to have a bill last year that would be a little bit more comprehensive. That didn't go through, and we're back again with a different bill that we think should still help a lot of families. What we hear time and time again is that a few hours of professional care could make a world of difference for caregivers who oftentimes have absolutely no time to themselves or have absolutely no training in how to do this. Nobody taught them how to take care of their parents as they're aging. Nobody taught them how to clean a wound that hasn't healed. I heard from a friend once who he took care of his mother after dialysis for over a decade, and he bathed her on a daily basis. And he always talked about how uncomfortable that was for him and for her, but he had to do that because there was nobody else to turn to. It was just him and his father taking care of their mother, saying, if I had had somebody to come in and help me to be able to give that kind of care for my mother, it would have made a world of difference, and a world of difference in their relationship too.
When you talk about the fund that would have to be directly appropriated, many people are going to say, okay, this year we know we have a lot less in the way of funds that we could appropriate because we simply don't have the dollars. In making these kinds of choices, has there also been an alternative looked at that might allow people to put into a fund such as the one that you're looking at creating to be able to draw on it?
Yeah, I think we're looking at all sorts of alternatives and making sure that we're looking at every sort of nook and cranny to be able to figure out some sort of solution for this issue. What we know is that we're getting older. Hawaii, as you mentioned, definitely has the longest lifespan in the union. We also have the fastest aging population. So if we don't act now, we won't be able to have a handle on this growing issue as we grow older. We call it the silver tsunami that is coming. And it's here. It's on our shores at this point. We believe that this bill and the fund that this creates a base of care for working families who need the most assistance, but it's certainly not the only solution, and we're looking at every single solution to be able to address that.
So, for example, if the money could not be found for doing this, what would be a next step to you that would be appropriate? I mean, to look at some sort of fund, maybe dollars that would be able to be appropriated from every person's paycheck that would be maybe tax-free or something that would allow them to build into a fund if that were something that we could do?
You know, I'm not sure that we've figured out what exactly might be that silver bullet. We're looking at other states as examples. What we're taking a look at very closely on this legislative season is to be able to say we need to have this care floor for at least for our working families. But I think it won't stop there. It definitely won't stop there. It will definitely need all of us to be able, in our own personal paychecks, we'll need to be able to be part of that as well.
Because we're all aging, and at some point, given the way things are going with the cost of assisted living, people who are spending $100,000 a year for care for their loved ones, few people are going to be able to afford that. as that continues to escalate. Thanks for coming in. We're going to be watching these bills.
Thank you very much, Beth.
Pedro Haro is the Hawaii Community Organizer for Caring Across Generations. That's a national movement of families, caregivers, people with disabilities, and aging Americans working to transform caregiving. He's also the campaign director for Care for Our Kupuna. It's the local movement to create a legislative plan for long-term care, including the creation of the Kupuna Caregivers Program we just talked about. Tomorrow, supporters will be gathering down at the Capitol for a rally at 10 o'clock.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a musical look at love in its many facets. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're celebrating the fact that there are no snakes in Hawaii, well, except in the ocean. There are about 4 dozen different sea snakes in Pacific waters, and only one is native to Hawaiian waters. That's the one we're looking for today. Even if you're in the water a lot, though, you're not likely to have seen one. They're fairly rare and very shy. That's a good thing because they are also extremely poisonous. The snake we're thinking about this morning is a distant relative of the cobra that has adapted to life in the ocean. It's an air-breathing marine reptile that can stay submerged for about 2 hours and dive to about 300 feet. It grows to about 25 to 30 inches in length, but it can grow as long as 44 inches. It's black with a brilliant yellow underside, and this morning, it's the one we'd like you to name. If you can, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right will get the prize.
Good morning. I'm Scott Sugai from Kapilani Children's Miracle Network Hospital. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The ancient Greeks loved to classify things, and love, that most unclassifiable of things, did not escape their attention. They thought about such things as love of the body, love of the mind, and love of humanity, and had a word for each. Singer and performance artist Willow Chang has crafted an evening of music based on the Greeks' 7 words for love. She's with us in our studio to give us a preview. Good morning, Willow.
Good morning.
I love this idea.
Thank you. And as a fellow nerd, I love it too. You know, I think one of the things that there's always a small element of melancholy that seems to also accompany Valentine's Day. And there's a huge commercial push to put and place emphasis on romantic love. And a lot of people who maybe are not feeling that in their heart, or they don't feel that it's current in their life, as a result, feel kind of bummed out. So I was thinking, how can we change the conversation and bring it back to all of the different facets that love can encompass, and et voila.
Well, it's one of the effects that these holidays, when you're supposed to be happy, could get to you for one in different ways, right?
Right. The International Singles Awareness Day.
You're having you're having happiness pounded into you by the holiday.
Yeah.
And, Well, the whole idea of melancholy leads us pretty well into the song we're going to do, and then let's do this song, and then I kind of want to talk to you about your choice of this particular song because it's one we both love. This
sure.
is My Funny Valentine. I'll just count it off real quick. 2, 3, and...
My funny valentine, sweet comic valentine, you make me smile with your heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? Are you smart? Don't change your hair for me. Not if you care for me.
Thanks, Willie. You sound great.
Thank you.
What is it about this song? You know, he or she is saying to him or her, "You're not that great looking. You're not even that
you
smart.
You can't take a selfie."
Right. Your lips are laughable. I mean, what?
Are you smart?
Yeah.
I know.
But I love you anyway. Is that the idea?
I think so. I think it's really, there's a truism that when you fall in love with somebody, or if you're lucky, maybe you're exceedingly intrigued by somebody, the things and the measuring stick and how we measure what's of value starts to change. Because mm-hmm. maybe your ideal is that you're going to accept and love somebody with all of their flaws and their peccadilloes and their
right.
quirks and their strangeness. And you suddenly start to fetishize things, that little mole that they have, or the strange way that they laugh, or, you know, all of their little OCD tendencies.
Right.
But I personally like smart, just for the record. You'll get bored pretty quickly otherwise.
Well, yeah, that's something a lot of people overlook. And you know, the whole idea that there are going to be things that you're going to have to accept whether you like them or not.
True. And right? I think also it's the idea of not placing someone on a pedestal, which is such the danger zone for any kind of relationship, whether it's familial or it's a coworker or it's your
Bound
roommate or yeah. I mean, the moment you place somebody on a pedestal, they can only fall. There's
yeah.
no place to go from once you're up there.
Good
so
advice.
Why not just love them the way that they are and hope that they can return the same?
Well, let's do a regular romance column thing on the show.
I like that. I hope romance isn't dead. Swipe right. Oh,
well, I don't think it's going to be dead at this show. And the whole idea of what is it, Eros?
Mm-hmm. We have philia. Forgive me, my Latin is
philia
not
great. Is what, love of the mind?
Or friendship and goodwill. There's storge. And that's like a familial love. And you uh-huh. have agape, right? So that's universal. And a lot of times you hear that in church, maybe a sacred type of love. pragma, which is duty. And the thing is that love is, it morphs, it changes. So I like to often think of love as like water. Water can be vapor, it can be steam, it could be an ocean or a stream or the rain, snow. They're all types of water, but they're all very distinctive and they're different. And sometimes they change shape. Hail, right? Hail yeah. was rain that froze. And love is like that. So you might start off with Eros and it's hot and it's passionate and it's steamy and it's thumping.
Right.
And then maybe it morphs into, you know,
pragmatism.
Pragma. Yeah. And you know, you can't discount that because it's still love, but it's very, very different. And if you're lucky enough to have love that even morphs more to you, because it means that you've stuck it out in some shape or form.
Sure.
You know, it didn't burn out and fizzle and poop out.
When you've seen a couple that's been together 50, 60 years, some pragma entered in, right?
Well, you know, it's funny because I grew up with my mom saying, oh, they're like an old married couple. I hope my mom's listening. And it was, and that can mean many different things, but I always thought that that was kind of a groovy thing. Like, you know, there's a certain kind of weather and you make the phone call and you're thinking, I'm dating myself, but, you know, where do you want to eat? And you're thinking, let's go to Makgully Chop Suey. And then your partner says, I'm really hankering for Makgully Chop Suey. And you're like, I felt the same way. I mean, when you know what you can get at the store or what you feel like eating together, or you know when you're kind of done with the carnival and you want to retreat and you can retreat together, those are all really beautiful and maybe underrated things that people take for granted. But, you know, should you be so lucky? L'chaim. Should your love last 100 years? It's all
Willow,
good.
It's obvious there's more to this show than just songs. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank
that
you
was
so
a lot
much.
Of fun.
I hope everyone can join. And you can come as you are and you can come stag and it's all good. You'll be amongst friends.
There you go. In honor of Valentine's Day, Willow Chang will perform an evening of songs that depict the seven kinds of love classified by the ancient Greeks. This includes well-known tunes from the theater, pop music, and jazz, and it's Saturday evening in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio.
It's a special day. We should celebrate and appreciate the you. Found something pretty neat. And I know some say this day is arbitrary.
Support for today's programming comes from Chamber Music Hawaii. Joe Moore hosts Maligned Master, Setting the Record Straight on Salieri, February 12th at Doris Duke Theater and on the 13th at Palikū Theater. ChamberMusicHawaii.org.
A promise to roll back Dodd-Frank sounds like good news for Wall Street and bad news for Main Street.
He promised he was going to be tough on Wall Street and he was going to help the working guy. And in fact, he is Wall Street's best gift in many years.
Barney Frank forecasts a new era under the businessman president. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Lawsuits and acts of defiance in cities around the country over President Trump's executive orders on immigration and travel have some in Hawaii asking this question: should Hawaii become a sanctuary state? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So we've been hearing about this where, you know, cities and states have been really vocal in the last couple of days, especially talking about what they will and what they won't do. What is Hawaii prepared to do?
Well, Hawaii is officially doing nothing, neither Honolulu as a city or Hawaii as a state to be a sanctuary. But there are efforts to change that. One is in the State House of Representatives. Kaniela Ng has a resolution that would declare Hawaii a sanctuary. He says we need to stand up. We need to hold values that are not xenophobic, and that he's hoping he can gain some support. There's some other people. One in the Senate, Carl Rhodes, seems to feel the same way. And then there's another effort, this from an anti-Trump group that was involved in the inaugural protest locally, trying to get Mayor Caldwell to do the same for the city. So far, neither the governor nor the mayor have said anything public about this, but certainly there will be some pressure going forward to see if we can attain that status.
Meanwhile, there is the lawsuit. And the way, you know, the Attorney General in Hawaii feels about Trump's executive orders. But this effort to create a resolution to bring in both Mayor Caldwell and the state itself, resolutions...
They're not really...
It's tough with a resolution because it may have a statement of a heartfelt ideas, but it's not necessarily something that has a lot of teeth to it.
Yeah, legal standing, it really is an expression of intent rather than to enact laws. And we should explain that by sanctuary, we mean that you would place limits, meaning a city or a state, on the local law enforcement enforcing immigration laws. And in this case, we're talking, of course, about Trump. On January 25th, he actually issued an order deputizing local law enforcement to be federal agents, essentially, authorized as immigration officers to investigate, apprehend, or even detain illegal aliens. And that's something that certainly goes against Attorney General Doug Chin's lawsuit filed Friday. There's a concern that to do this, you'd be turning the police, other law enforcement locally, against people here who are undocumented. And by the way, Louis Kinnea in his story today reports there's 21,000 undocumented aliens in the state of Hawaii. There's a concern from some that, boy, you'd be building a lot of mistrust if suddenly police officers are acting as immigration agents when they, you know, stop you for a traffic light or something like that. Show me your papers.
Right. That's exactly the point, that might put us into a situation where they're not necessarily to enforce the infraction for which they might have pulled you over, but in fact to be able to throw you out of the state.
Yeah, on the plus side, just real quickly, there are some court rulings that have indicated that local municipalities might be protected against these federal impositions, although the federal government does rule. And then there's some churches, at least a dozen congregations locally, saying, look, we'll take people in if we have to. So there are those that are trying to do what they can outside of the governmental intrusion here.
Well, we'll see what happens with the rezo and if it breeds anything else. Thanks so much. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. If you have children in your life, you probably want to keep them safe and healthy. And judging by the advertising that continues to show up on screens and in print, that means plenty of antibacterial everything in your house, car, purse, you name it. The problem is that science just doesn't agree. University of British Columbia professor Brett Finley certainly doesn't. He's the co-author of Let Them Eat Dirt. He's in Hawaii this week and in our studio right now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And it's not just, we should say, the antibacterial stuff. It's also the whole issue over how many antibiotics a child, you know, should be given. But the bottom line of it seems to be that we're just beginning to understand how we may, in fact, through all the good intentions, be undercutting a child's immune system.
Yeah. For the last 125 years, we've been on this kick to get rid of microbes that cause disease, which are called germs. And we've done a really good job of this. So we've gotten rid of most of the infections that kids normally have. So we brought in sanitation, antibiotics, vaccines, clean water, garbage disposal. And that worked really well. And I think we should be proud of that. But I think we've now reached what I call a hygiene hangover. We are getting too clean. And in our effort to get rid of these bad microbes, things like antibiotics, which kill good and bad microbes equally, what we realize is we're actually depriving our bodies and the microbes that we've evolved with through the human history, and we're actually depriving kids of the natural microbes they would normally encounter. And what the science is now telling us, this actually has effect on how the kids develop and their general health and disease. And this is impacting what we call Western society diseases, such as asthma and obesity and allergies and autism and inflammatory bowel disease. I mean, just look around the world. What diseases do we have? They're these. And ironically, in just about all cases, there are links to the microbial involvement in that. And so this hyper-clean world we live in, we now realize that, well, it's worked for getting rid of the germs, but we've now gone too far. And these kids don't get the microbes they should have.
In trying to replenish them, we have had other efforts to do that, too, as if suddenly we know exactly which microbes they need to have. I mean, we're all watching sort of the whole probiotic wave happening, mm-hmm. too. Why is that not effective?
Well, I think probiotics were designed to be something that's safe, but they don't necessarily have to work, and they're not regulated by the FDA, so they're not standard drugs. So pretty much anything we claim to be a probiotic. Probiotic is just a live microbe, but often they're not taken from the body site that they're meant for. You know, often they're vaginal microbes going, putting in the gut. And most probiotics you have to take in a billion to 10 billion a day, they don't stick, they don't form part of the community. So I think we just haven't added the right microbes yet. I think the concept that, in a sense, it's good, we realize we're depriving our microbes, but we don't have the right microbes to fix them yet, so maybe we shouldn't deprive them in the first place.
So let's talk about, you know, this simple stuff. Maybe stop using all the antibiotics as much. I mean, kids have, what, on average, about 10 or 11 courses of antibiotics, right, by the time that they reach college age?
Yeah, so antibiotics are a wonder drug. They have saved countless people's lives due to bacterial infections. The problem with antibiotics is they kill both the germs and the normal microbes. And so we know that when you take antibiotics, especially early in life, it has drastic effects on all the microbes in you. And this repeated insult to these microbes shifts your microbes away from a healthy way. So if you take antibiotics in the first year of life, you have a much higher chance of becoming asthmatic, of becoming obese, of becoming diabetic. And so we realize these things are having a profound effect. They also affect the health or the weight gains, and we use them in agriculture to increase weight. And there's some thought that the increased antibiotic use increases child weight too. So they're a great drug if you're dying of a bacterial infection, but if you have a viral ear infection, which antibiotics don't work, you know, maybe when the doctor says go home and wait a day and we'll see what happens, there's a reason for that. And if you do need them, use them, but you don't need them for many things that we do use them now for.
The other thing that you could do very quickly is just eschew all the antibacterial stuff that we're told we need to have. Triclosan doesn't work. Mm-hmm. That's been shown. But this idea seeming to feed into the need to be clean, as opposed to understanding that, as you say, being too clean, in fact, depresses the immune system, mm-hmm, and can undercut it. You know, there are a lot of people who are marketing all kinds of stuff who just don't want to hear that.
Of course. I mean, every bottle of Purell says kills 99% germs. Well, it kills 99% of all microbes, and the FDA has now stopped that because there's no data to say that worked. I mean, good old-fashioned soap and water once a day before you eat dinner is going to do as much good as washing your kids 100 times a day with Purell. And the problem with washing them all the time with Purell is you take the good microbes off the kids' hands, and they're then the bad ones can crawl in too. So, yeah, I think the idea of bubble wrapping our children and don't let them encounter anything in the world. Let's keep them clean. You know, you see where it came from. You know, if clean is good, cleaner is better. We now realize that's not necessarily true, and we're depriving our kids of the natural microbes they need, and all these things like hand sanitizers are contributing to this.
The bottom line, I hear you say, is just, for heaven's sake, use some common sense. But common sense has not necessarily been walking lockstep with a lot of innovation and, mm-hmm, you know, what we have seen particularly coming from the pharmaceutical corner.
That's very true. And, you know, it's hard to program common sense at times in the world. But we know in the last 5 to 7 years, up until then, we thought cleaner is better. We didn't really think anything about all the microbes we were killing, you know, and we just didn't really think of it. But study after study after study is now coming out overwhelmingly showing that we are doing damage by doing this. And, you know, whether common sense or not, I mean, the data says that we shouldn't be doing this if we want to be healthy.
So especially for new parents, relax. You know, if the binky goes on the floor, so what? You know, give it a little wash off. Or I've seen moms pop it into their own mouths before they put it back.
There's a great study on that about binky use, that if you put it in your own mouth and then and then in the kid's mouth, as opposed to wash it off. If you put it in your own mouth, those kids will have less rates of asthma, obesity, and diabetes just by the simple fact of putting it in your own mouth. And so a lot of what we try and do in the book is give parents common sense tips that, yeah, don't freak out. I mean, kids, we have an immune system, and it's really important for the kids to use this thing. And ironically, by not exposing them to these things, they don't get to use it. And, you know, then that causes big problems down the line.
So let them play in the mud. It's okay.
Well, if you watch a kid in action, what do? They try and put every possible thing they can into their mouth. If that was so bad for them, we would have evolved not to do that. So I think, you know, let kids be kids. You know, they're going to do this, and let them chew on a bit of dirt.
All right. We'll leave it there at that moment. Thank you. And here's to greater microbes for our kids.
Love your microbes. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Brett Finley is the co-author with Marie-Claire Arrieta of Let Them Eat Dirt, Saving Your Child from an Over-Sanitized World. Dr. Finley also serves as a distinguished professor at the University of British Columbia and is a world leader on bacterial infections and microbes. He'll be speaking tomorrow night at UH Manoa. Details are on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, featuring music by Mozart and Schubert. Joseph Swenson performs and conducts February 18th and 19th at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Tonight at 5 is The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, you're going to talk about vaccines and what they can do for us, huh?
We are. You know, I had a unique opportunity to record this show earlier with Dr. Andrew Kroger of the Centers for Disease Control, and he currently is one of the physicians working to establish the scheduled routine of immunizations from, you know, birth to the end of life. So we actually went through a complete age-related description of all the different vaccines that are available, the pros, the cons, new vaccines that are on the horizon, and we talk a little bit about why people should get that second Hep A shot, too.
I'm assuming he also talks about the whole idea that people are starting to oppose the idea of vaccines, yeah?
Well, you know, and a lot of that is based on a previous study put out many years ago that was already looked at and determined not to link vaccines. In that case, it was Andrew Wakefield's study with vaccines and autism. And so, you know, part of the difficulty is that if we look historically, people are not dying of the diseases for which we've developed vaccines, and we don't see outbreaks unless we find a little pocket of people who are not vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
So we do talk about the reason why people should highly consider getting vaccinated. It's always going to be a choice for parents and their children, but most parents are not going to want to put their kids at risk, and we do talk about that on the show.
It certainly is. The more you understand, the more likely you are to make an informed decision, yeah?
Absolutely, and I think, you know, a lot of parents have gotten the shots themselves, so they'll be able to learn from this discussion, too.
Thanks a lot, Kathy. That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Aloha, I'm Floyd Takeuchi from Honolulu. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet, plus what to look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. This week, Stargazers, we can continue to enjoy the celestial trio of Venus, the Moon, and Mars. All three objects are in the western sky around sunset. Now, the Moon will be progressing to its full phase towards the end of the week, so enjoy these dark skies while you can.
And there is some more new equipment up at the Mauna Kea summit, I understand, and you've got information on that.
Yes, the team at the Subaru Observatory atop Mauna Kea have stunned the scientific community once more with the construction and testing of an advanced instrument that will take detection of extrasolar planets to a whole new level. It's called the Subaru Coronagraphic Extreme Adaptive Optics.
That is quite a mouthful. How does this one work?
It works by reducing the distortions in an image that are caused by the movements of the Earth's atmosphere. These movements cause our images from telescopes to be blurry, and the new adaptive optics system corrects most of these distortions and provides incredible image quality.
Is that why we don't see too many images of planets in other solar systems?
Yeah. The hunt for extrasolar planets is tricky because planets are small and dim compared to stars, which are enormous and bright. The most reliable way we can detect the presence of planets is through watching how a star dims as a planet passes in front, or detecting the wobble of a star caused by an orbiting large planet.
Is this a really really big piece of equipment?
It is. It's made up of several different cameras and a whole host of optical instruments.
So those other methods don't sound like they can tell us as much.
They can't, really. We can determine some physical properties of a planet, but the really exciting stuff, such as what the atmosphere is made of and whether there may be indicators of life, are all hidden. The new adaptive optics system will change the game, and in the near future, it could allow us to probe these details and get some really cool science.
And I understand you've got an image to go along with our report this week.
Yes, indeed. Our listeners can see it on the Stargazer website. It's actually a picture of a distant solar system, and in it you can see the actual positions of the planets have been picked out.
Well, this is a fun toy, and I'm looking forward to some more developments with it. And folks can go to HawaiiPublicRadio.org to take a look at what Christopher's talking about. It's Christopher Phillips, and thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We will be back with another edition of Stargazer next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about a deadly sea snake that lives in Hawaiian waters, although it's rarely seen. That's probably just as well, because their bite can be lethal, although no fatalities have ever been recorded here. They range in length, full grown, from about 25 to 44 inches, and are among the most common of sea snake species worldwide. They eat fish, catching their prey with a sideways strike of the head, paralyzing it and eating it whole. The teeth aren't sharp enough to penetrate most wetsuits, and they're not aggressive, so some divers have been known to capture and handle them. But experts say that's a very bad idea. Their Latin name is Palamis blatterus, but most people know them as the yellow-bellied sea snake.
And Michael Delaney called us from Manoa. He knew that, and will be receiving the prize. That's today's Backyard Quiz. If you've got one for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
We seem to be in a new era of protest in America, and that got us thinking about the role protest songs have played throughout our history. Keith Haugen is a veteran performer of songs that contain a public call to action. In 1993, the 100th anniversary of the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy, he won a songwriting contest with Ika La'apopo, a song that calls on Hawaiians to rise up and claim what is rightfully theirs. He's with us this morning with some thoughts about the role of the singer-songwriter in any protest movement. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. You know, you and I both remember when we first heard songs like We Shall Overcome, Bob Dylan's
yes.
Blowin' in the Wind, songs by, songwriters like Phil Oakes, who isn't that remembered these days, but, you know, Phil Oakes wrote We Ain't A-Marchin' Anymore.
Yeah.
That was a large part of the, certainly that particular movement. We just heard that John Fogerty song Fortunate Son that got adopted by, you know, the guys in Vietnam. Why songs? What is it about songs, Keith?
Well, I think the appeal of music is international, and I think it attracts songwriters to write songs like that because they recognize that they can have an influence on public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And it dates way back, as you know. I think of the spirituals and stuff, Study War No More and songs mm-hmm. like that.
Sure.
Probably made a major influence on a lot of people back in those days, and it hasn't changed at all.
It's a direct route to the emotions, for one thing.
Correctly, yeah.
Well, it's certainly something that you've done throughout your career as a songwriter, isn't it?
I have. I often look at the songs that I've written over the years and think of them as music with a message, because I try to focus on a strong message that either I have very strong feelings about, or that I know an audience will have strong feelings about. And war is one, of course, War and Peace, and so I've written quite a few in that genre.
you know, I kind of see what you do as kind of as a descendant of people like Pete Seeger with the Weavers, Woody Guthrie, coming out of that world, right?
Yeah. Icons who have become my idols.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Pete Seeger is a great example of that.
Yeah, because he was all, you know, he never failed to perform at a benefit, for one thing.
Yeah.
There at the March on Washington and all that.
And he had a knack for getting the entire audience involved to sing along on the songs that carried a message he wanted to make.
That's no reason why that tradition should ever go away, is there?
It shouldn't. It shouldn't. And I don't think it will, because songwriters are inspired by things like that. It's easier to write a song about an issue that you feel strongly about than something that you have to just conjure up for which you have no special aloha.
Well, Keith, let's hear a little bit. First of all, first let's hear just a fragment of the song you wrote about the overthrow. And what do those lines mean, Keith?
The song, that says the people cry for their queen, says they cry because of the overthrow. They have all passed on, also the monarch, the queen's gone. And indeed, only thing that remains is their land. And I wrote that in 1993 when they were marked the 100th anniversary of the overthrow.
Mm-hmm.
And although not many of my songs were inspired by song contests, this one was. The Friends of the Royal Hawaiian Band announced a contest for songs in the Hawaiian language which would relate to the overthrow of 1893.
Mm-hmm.
And it inspired me to write this song. And I knew that I was writing to a specific audience because the song says, sovereignty will return tomorrow. And a lot of people don't believe that sovereignty should ever return, but a lot of people do. And it appealed mostly to that latter category.
What kind of response have you gotten to that song?
Well, when I first released it, I had quite a bit of response, all positive, because the people who might not agree with it didn't understand it. It was in the Hawaiian language,
and
they didn't
get
it. But the song really, you know, it's, the chorus of it says, rise up, Hawaiians, rise up, descendants, and claim what's rightfully yours, and meaning the land, of course. And those who understood the Hawaiian lyrics responded in a nice way. At the time, there were several other sovereignty songs that came out, and I think they all had an effect on the Hawaiian-speaking population.
Again, sort of tapping into, you know, getting past the words, the issues,
yes,
right to the emotion.
Yeah.
There's another song that we were thinking about, your song, Ceasefire. What inspired that?
Well, I was inspired when Iraq and Iran were at war back in 1987, 88, and we were supplying weapons to both sides. And that really upset me. It didn't seem like a thing that America should be doing. And so I wrote the song called Ceasefire. Actually, I wrote it as a Christmas song. And it had good response at the time, but it got its recognition 20 years later when they finally... on International Peace Day, 20 years after I'd written it, they gave me an award from the both houses of the state legislature and the Spark Matsunaga Institute for Peace for writing lyrics that made sense about peace. And I called it Ceasefire, and everybody said, you can't call a Christmas song Ceasefire. And I said, I don't know, why not? And we're celebrating the Prince of Peace.
What better time, right?
Yeah.
Let's hear a little bit of that, Keith.
Thank you.
Not far from where the Christ child lay, men are killing men today. While we talk of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Bombs and rockets light the sky where angels once sang on high. And we supply the weapons that spell their bloody end.
Keith, that song builds on the obvious irony of war going on in the Holy Land, right?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, people could relate to that. And, of course, that would have failed if I'd have written it in Hawaiian, perhaps. But it reached a larger audience. And I had mixed emotions from this. Like I said, I had some people who said I shouldn't have a song called Ceasefire at Christmas time. And I said that seemed like the most appropriate time for me. And it goes on, you know, to say that somewhere on this blessed earth there's been trouble ever since before his birth. Men cried out, and we ignored their pleas. And I wanted to make a point that, and at that particular time, that it was wrong for us to be supplying weapons to two sides that are fighting each other, because that kind of defeated the whole purpose of what we stand for, you know.
And yet there were undoubtedly at that time cynical voices saying, let them wipe each other out, right?
There were lots of them. In fact, when I finally got the recognition for that song 20 years after I had written and first recorded and released it, I had people who remembered that some of the radio stations, for instance, refused to play it. And the reason they refused it was they thought Ceasefire was not an appropriate title for a Christmas song.
The whole idea that that ceasing fire would be an unpatriotic, un-Christmassy emotion. Thanks so much, Keith.
Thank you.
To talk to you.
Chris,
Keith Haugen is a songwriter and the author of Ikala Apopo, a song about the 1893 overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy, and the song you just heard, Ceasefire. You can read the lyrics to Ikala Apopo in Hawaiian and English on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Aloha, this is Jeremy Hobson, co-host of Here and Now, NPR's Midday News Magazine show, and we are thrilled to be joining the Hawaii Public Radio lineup starting February 14th. We all know that news doesn't just happen during drive time, and on Here and Now, we're all about keeping it fresh and keeping you updated with in-depth news and important conversations. Listen for us on HPR1 every weekday morning at 10, starting February 14th.
Beth Ann, as Keith Haugen just said, the best impetus for a song is an emotion that you feel powerfully, and that could include, you know, getting a little political sometimes.
Or these days, a lot.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder if this new, and I really think that there is a new aura of protest in the country. I'm wondering if it will produce its We Shall Overcome, its Blowing in the Wind, the kind of songs that, you know, those of us who remember the 60s remember.
And there are a lot of people who were around in the 60s who are looking at this as a new opportunity to revivify some of those ideas that have been with us but not necessarily at the forefront in the way that they feel that they should. And now perhaps we have the opportunity.
Well, we certainly got the opportunity.
All right. Now, you may have heard about the hiring freeze on shipyard workers and that Navy shipyards are exempt. Tomorrow, we're going to talk with the president of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers about other hiring issues that the freeze is highlighting.
And the Maui Science Center gives fledgling engineers a chance to test their mettle.
Now, you've heard the news that we're moving. Well, what does moving really mean? Well, starting next week on Tuesday, the conversation will move to 11 a.m. on the FM dial. For those on the Big Island, that means tuning in to 91.1 in Hilo. All the other frequencies are on our website. You can take a look and see where you can find us come next Tuesday.
And if you missed any of this show or want to hear a past show or hear something again, just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you back here tomorrow morning at 8 for The Conversation.